host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Mayor Tony Hart makes New Haven tick. And she's here in the studio for her regular Mayor Monday checkup on what she and we are up to in New Haven. You can join the conversation by posting a question on our New Haven Independent Facebook Live page or calling at 203-872-7ELM, 203-872-7356. Today's program is made possible in part thanks to support from Bertram Moses and Devlin PC, from Gateway Community College in downtown New Haven. Thanks, Gateway. Thanks, Bertram. And thanks, Mayor Hart. It is a pleasure to see you back in the studio. You know, you're busier than anyone I know on the weekends, and yet you probably are the liveliest person to come into the studio on Monday morning. Maybe there's a relationship between those two facts, but welcome. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Well, happy birthday. Yesterday was your birthday.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm very uninterested in my own birthdays at this age. How do you feel about yours?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of like it's really nice because I got an opportunity to spend some time with my family, so I enjoyed that. But other than that, you know, it's another day, and you just keep on pushing, right?
Do you feel younger, older? Does the numbers? What is the number?
I'm 70.
70. How's that feel?
The same way it did. It's 69, and
does it feel like a lot different from 69?
No, you know what? I think what makes you feel differently. And it doesn't feel any different than 50 or any of those ages, really. But what you do see is that it's really important that we prepare our young people. You really see how important it is that young people are ready to inherit the earth and our town, and that we have done everything that we can to assure that young people are ready to basically take over. And So I think that from that perspective, it's really important. For me, more than ever, education is important.
People are stunned when I tell them you're over 60. Like, stunned.
Really?
And when you think about it, people are thinking about starting to be president of the United States in their first term at 76 or 78, which actually I think is crazy.
Yeah, it is a little.
But I don't think it's crazy that people are able to do so much more and have so much longer productive lives than before.
I think I think that if you take really good care of yourself, and that's what young people need to know too, you take good care of yourself, you eat right. You know, I didn't really exercise all that much, but you need to do that.
You eat right and you're active. I've spied you at Edge of the Woods in one of those aisles. You know, you definitely take care of yourself.
And I think that if you take care of yourself, yourself will take care of you.
Okay, in addition to enjoying your birthday with your family, I did have spies tell me you were still everywhere this weekend, including Hoop It Up. Did you stop by there?
I stopped by there, yes.
See, I hope you don't mind. I'm going to continue calling it Hoop It Up, even though you've changed
the name. I call it that, too.
That's so much of a better name than the Big Three Ball Out Tournament.
I know. That's some whole mouthful, isn't it?
Yeah. But did you change it because other cities are involved? You want to acknowledge that Hartford and Bridgeport are there?
No, I think that what happened was that Hoop It Up went out of business.
Oh, it was a national group we were part of.
Yeah. And so... We couldn't really use their name, you know. I asked Jason Bartlett, should we try to buy the name? Because we bought all of their equipment, and so it's ours, and we're going to continue the 3-on-3 basketball. But I'm wondering if we should make it something easier to say, because Hoop It Up is real easy.
So you know what? They can sue us. We will continue calling it Hoop It Up at the Independent.
Yeah,
if they have a problem, they can come see us.
Yeah.
So what you do is you close off Church Street in front of City Hall.
Right.
For Saturday and Sunday afternoon, for I think 6 hours or so. You have all these tournaments, teams at all ages, young kids, medium-aged kids, young adults. I remember when Sly Williams was there with his son
the year
I went. And they have 3-on-3 with a fourth person on the team, you know, to substitute. And it's pretty good competition, really busy. And the main idea is that you keep people busy in the summer doing productive stuff, right?
That's the main idea. But what I've been told is that there are groups of people that are trying to make 3-on-3 basketball something that is an Olympic sport.
Really?
So that maybe down the road there'll be opportunities for young people who do that to compete internationally.
And it's easier to stage a 3-on-3 game than a 5-on-5. You need fewer people. And if I'm not wrong, getting way beyond my expertise here, half court, right? Not full court?
It's half court.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so that's a lot easier to do. And you had so many games going on there. Really fun.
Yeah.
And the fact that you close off the center town, run for City Hall, make use of the green to have music and everything. I thought that was a really good idea.
No, it was a great idea. And and everybody loves it. We had people come from as far away as Philadelphia.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah.
We had a reporter. Yeah, wow. And meanwhile, on the other part of town in Westville, Saturday night, you had a big crowd. I think it might have been sold out. Reese Stadium, which I never knew was the name of a stadium at that whole Yale complex.
Mm-hmm.
There's a professional soccer team in town this year called the Elm City Express.
Right.
And they made it in their first year to the semifinals of their league, New England League, or North American League, I think. And they won 2-0. People had a great time. We had a story about the Independent, and they're going to be in the finals next week.
Yeah, I think that's great.
You know, there's always this question of how professional sports does it in New Haven. Over the years, it's changed. We've become much more of an arts city. Coliseum wasn't working. Several iterations of the hockey team didn't work. Mm-hmm. Several iterations of our minor league baseball team kept going down from double A, single A, not A, and people still weren't going no matter what. But they're making a go for it with soccer. We have an international community in New Haven that loves soccer, including homeborn, you know, American-born people, but also we have very active leagues of people from other countries. And I heard that was a really great night, and that Saturday night's the final.
Yeah, I didn't get to go to that, but I heard it was great, too. And look, we're hopeful that we're going to win so that we can really celebrate here in the city. And, you know, for years and years, I would go down Boulevard on Sunday especially and just see people out there parked every which way at the soccer game. So soccer's huge here.
And that's people do cross boundaries playing in that league. Lots of people got to know other people and they have a good time, and it's a wonderful thing. Did you go to New Hartville reunion?
Yes, I did.
What was that all about?
Well, it was, I think there are a number of reunions that happen across the city. This one's been going on for about officially for 4 years. I think it started unofficially before that. And there are people who grew up in New Hartville who come back. They have free food. They have things for kids to do.
Is it Lincoln Bassett?
Was it Lincoln Bassett?
Everything seems to be at Lincoln Bassett.
Yeah. They also there were having a basketball competition that ended on Sunday. And, some people were complaining that we did our 3-on-3 basketball at the same time. But we'll probably be more careful not to do that in the future. But
there's still plenty of people playing, I bet.
Oh, plenty of people playing. It was really great. So.
All right. And Frank Douglas writes in on Facebook Live, happy belated birthday to Mayor Harp.
Oh, thank you very much,
Frank.
He's
the older in Dwight, and he's running again. I saw you start your weekend early at Cafe 9. And I will say for the record that you and your entourage were not drinking anything alcoholic, although I think you're allowed to, but you had water, ice water. But you were hearing a urban-suburban, wait, is that what they called? Suburban, which was an R&B rap duo related stepkids, I guess, of Tomas Reyes, your chief of staff.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they were the first act on a very diverse bill at Cafe Nina that night. Redania, who's getting quite a following. This is a woman who went Lebanese-born, went to ECA, has like way out music, went second. But I was interested in Suburban. I mean, it's your take, because it seemed like the two brothers who front it, one of them is very classically trained, very melodic singer.
Right.
And he was doing sort of a real kind of classic R&B thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd switch off and his brother was doing rap with the same kind of backing of the music.
Right.
I thought that was kind of a good mix,
I thought it was
like
good,
salt and pepper
yeah.
type thing.
I was really, I thought they were really good, and it was a fun night. It was the first night I'd been in a club for like many years, and so I really enjoyed them. I was really surprised. Evidently, most of the people who played in the band go to West Conn and are really gifted musicians, but it decided to come together with this kind of neo R&B type sound, and it was really
fun
good.
To see brothers too.
Yeah,
so I don't know them, so I'm imagining all this stuff that they have different talents, and they're in their early 20s and they're doing this together and combining it that way, and relating to each other and taking music and within one song into different directions and back, which was
right.
fun. You're getting a lot of happy birthdays here, Mayor Harp Live. Jesse Ray's Barbecue, happy birthday Mayor Harp, all capitals. Whereas Ratasha Smith does not use all capitals. Happy belated birthday, Mayor Harp, but it has 3 exclamation points and an emoji.
All right.
Wink. Okay. Cafe 9 is always used to me too, because it's that little spot. It used to be Blue Barts years ago. It's become the place for sort of alt bands of all different stripes who tour, as well as locals. That's where they all get to play, kind of when they want people who listen to the music.
Right.
So they play 365 days a year and twice on some days. There's live music once or twice a day, often with 3 acts on the bill. I saw one of my favorite shows in years there 2 weeks ago. Tony Trischka, who's a a famous bluegrass musician from the 60s, 70s, and 80s took together a band of young people to reinterpret Bob Dylan songs. And all of us were over 55 that night. Uh-huh. Nixie brought us chairs to sit. And it was so much fun. It just sounded so good. And I'm thinking, you know, there were all these plans for within a block of that. It's a block from the old Coliseum. It's across the railroad track from two projects that now have the green light, non-subsidized. Things we used to dream about in New Haven 30 years ago. Now we don't even have to beg them to come, which is to have like 500 apartments plus stores and everything. And I'm thinking they're poised. People don't know because this isn't marketed. This isn't government. This isn't a big college music hall, which is also great on College Street. Right there in the middle of it is this Greenwich Village style, comfortable, low-cost, original music venue that I'm wondering if that is just going to fly when people even know what they're getting when they start moving into apartments at that kind of place.
Oh, I think it will. I think people are, and it's walkable. You can just walk there. You can walk across the street and really enjoy original music. And I mean, I was pleasantly surprised.
And really. Then you go halfway up the block at the old firehouse.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is something within like jazz, conoscente, shanty circles nationally we're known for, which is Firehouse 12.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bar, and I can never go because the concerts are on Friday night, which is Sabbath. I've gone when it's not Friday night. They get the cutting edge kind of jazz experimental people who play in New York a lot and record a lot, and they have their own label that they record. They moved it. It used to be just a few blocks away where those new apartments are coming. They moved out somewhere else in town. I forget where. Nick Lloyd's been doing that. That's when Nice Square really started happening 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But that place is really well-known, that kind of specific. Then you got Scapo on the same block.
Mm-hmm.
And it's these distinctive New Haven businesses that I think really make the Nice Square.
I think so, too. And it's what actually began to make all of downtown. People walk from State Street all the way up almost to not quite to House Street, but to Park Street, and just have a great time throughout almost every day, but especially on the weekends here.
But as one over 60-year-old, loving New Haven person who lives at 360 State a block away, wrote in on one of our Cafe 9 shows, I'd love to go sometime, but it's way past my bedtime, because those people really do start at 10 at night, except for the jazz shows, those start at 30, and except for Mayor Monday. On WNHH Radio, your home for community radio at 103.5 FM, live streamed to newhavenatbennett.org, where we do Mayor Monday at 11 a.m. on Monday. Everybody's up. And we do replay it often during the week. So we're here with Mayor Monday, with Mayor Tony Harp, checking in and getting birthday wishes from folks on Facebook Live. So today, the Duncan Hotel, another New Haven tradition, is about to change. Duncan Hotel is on the block between Chapel Street, between York and Park.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, has that block changed over the years.
Yeah.
The Yale Art School taking over the rundown abandoned JCC, the old Colony Inn becoming the upscale study at Yale, the restaurants kind of strengthened. And now that Duncan, which has sort of been this colorful single room occupancy where you get poor people, odd people have plenty of money doing single rooms with the bathroom down the hall. I was talking to Ben Verdery, who was the chairman of the guitar program at Yale, international musician who always stays there for a week or two at a time when he comes to teach at Yale because he likes the ambiance. You have the oldest elevator in Connecticut with an elevator operator. It's a little down the heels, but it's clean. And it's also a hotel. They gave everyone until November 1st to leave because a Chicago developer of boutique hotels is buying it and building it into an upscale hotel, which is a trend in the country. Mm-hmm. Boutique hotels that have character. They're competing at high end against chains for people who want that local talent. So Randy Salvatore, the developer, does these hotels. And he's going to be doing one, as you know, at George Street and High, which he's about to break ground. Colony Inn is that kind of hotel. It has that study Yale theme.
Mm-hmm.
So any thoughts? I know your administration was involved in making sure that there'd be relocation for these tenants.
Well, I think the most important thing that we worry about is whether or not we can relocate folks. I remember when I worked for the Cornell Scott Hill Health Center, a lot of our patients who were homeless or just out of jail, as soon as they got their SSI check, they would go to the Duncan for a few days and really feel like they were in a decent place and were just like everybody else. And it really provided that role for folks that have a difficult time in our community. It was a few days that they could feel like everybody else.
So. And there are others that have been there 20 years.
Yeah.
I've talked to three people on Sunday alone who live there, who used to work for the Register of the Journal Courier back in the day, like 70s and 80s, writing articles, became writers. One became a photographer who had a studio in the Duncan. You know, $170, $200, you live there. And they said, you know, if some of them lived at other SROs, single room occupancy place, say this was very different than at other places. They're flea bags. And here they're not like the shiny object, expensive places, but they actually, and I looked, it was clean. And he said, you do get to know the people and they love the staff. You know, for people getting kicked out of a place, I did not hear a single bad word or resentful word about the Duncan. It was so odd. They said, you know, they're giving us 3 months. They hired the Glendower Group, which is an arm of the Housing Authority of New Haven, to help relocate them. They're starting meetings today about getting help. So I guess the question is, I was talking about Emerson, your economic development administrator. He said the challenge for a city like ours is that we, he says we should celebrate that that block in downtown is getting so busy. People want to be here. There's demand for high-end rooms. But how do we make sure that people who also work at these kind of places can afford to live there and be down? Maybe they can't afford to live downtown. Maybe you can't afford to live in that block anymore. I mean, I think that's really the last place I know of where you can get a room like that in the center. And these people said, we don't have cars. We'd like to walk. And they're not all, by the way, down and out. Some of them are just kind of quirky. And some of them are down and out. And some of them are have the money, but not for like, you know, $3,000 a month at the 360 state.
And they like living where the action is, living downtown. And I think one of the one of our challenges is to make sure that that can happen. I know that when we started talking about the Ninth Square, and there's a lot of affordable housing within the housing complexes there. And we've got to make sure that we maintain those and that to the degree that we can when we're not involved as a partner, we've got to make sure that there's access to that kind of housing downtown for everyone across the income spectrum.
Now, Joel Schiavone, who developed the first round of downtown new urbanism, he used to argue that he thinks it's okay that if the value of real estate changes in part, and we used to argue about this. I'm not saying I was right. You know, I was a young person. I'm sure I was right about everything. I no longer am about any of this, right or wrong. He used to say it's okay that values change in parts of town because in the first round of what some people call gentrification, in most cases, I would argue, is not kicking people out in New Haven, but it was somewhat in the 80s when he was downtown in that area, that block with the Duncan. There was a place called the El Dorado, two doors down, where poor people lived in a hotel type place. And an SRO right above Claire's. Those are all that. Joel Schiavone cleared those people out. There weren't many. There were like 20 in one and 50 in another, but there were legal aid lawsuits to try to help them relocate. And he used to say, look, we should house those people in a city, but they don't have to be in what becomes the most valuable real estate that creates our tax revenue. Other people say, look, the Ninth Square is a different model. And John DeStefano, your professor, came to embrace that in his term halfway, which is that you could still do both and that there's a value in combining them.
I think it's really important that you combine. I think that if you don't, you're really just building ghettos. And that ultimately undermines communities and neighborhoods. And you really want to make sure that you have mixed, I guess they call it mixed income, mixed income. It's important for a number of reasons, not the least of which is just sort of building a more consistent view among all of our folks around what a city is and our commitment to a city that goes among all income groups.
Great. And you're listening to Mayor Monday with Mayor Tony Hart, who is here with our regular checkup. Mayor Hart, we have a question that came in on Facebook Live from Tom Breen. Mayor Hart, do you think that Mayor Ganim of Bridgeport should qualify? And I know you love to like have to answer questions about your fellow mayor's favorite questions to get, right? What do you think about Mayor Ganim qualifying for public financing for his 2018 gubernatorial bid? This is an interesting question. He's planning on suing the state's Election Enforcement Commission for barring him from public financing because of his previous public corruption felony. So Mayor Ganim's the mayor of Bridgeport. He went to jail, came back, won a seat back. You've been working with him in coalition with other mayors to try to preserve urban funding in the state. He's running for governor. Because he's a felon, he can't qualify for public financing, which is all ironic because he went to jail for like taking bribes from people trying to influence rich people government. And now he wants to be the clean government candidate and saying you're not clean enough to run clean. Any thoughts?
Well, you know, I think that one of the things that we struggle with in our society is whether or not once a person's committed a crime and paid their debt to society, if it's really paid. And, you know, I would argue that if he's a politician and he meets every other, and he meets all the qualifications, why would you use that to hold against his actually participating in something that would be a cleaner way of, and difficult, by the way of raising money for a statewide campaign? I think we do it all the time, that people end up committing these low-level crimes. Substance use and abuse comes to mind right away. And, you know, they end up spending the rest of their lives paying for it, even though they've gone to prison oftentimes and you've supposedly paid for it.
Is this analogous to restoring people's voting rights?
I think it is. Yeah, absolutely.
So I guess the counter-argument would be that this is a special privilege above voting rights, which is that if you're a politician who's abused the public trust of money, you shouldn't have access to more public money to be in that position again.
But then I think that's a decision that the legislature should make, and not a body that is not elected, and it should be debated, and I don't believe that it was.
And speaking of paying debt to society, did you happen to see last week, it was a little bit under the radar, the case of Reginald Dwayne Betts.
Yeah, I wasn't happy with that either. It's sort of like...
That was incredible.
Yeah.
So just people know, Reginald Dwayne Betts, when he was younger, many decades ago, he did an armed robbery and went to jail. He came out and became maybe the most amazing ex-con ever. He got a 4.0 college degree, got a Yale Law degree, a Harvard Radcliffe Fellowship, got an MFA. He worked in public defender's office here in New Haven. He wrote celebrated books. He speaks all the time at college, at prisons and schools. And, of course, he passed the bar exam. And the Connecticut bar said you can't be a lawyer. Even though you passed the exam and practice, you don't have the right. That's just mind-blowing.
It is mind-blowing. And that's what I say. You know, we struggle with that. You know, like how long, once you've paid your debt to society, do you?
And, of course, you know, my favorite comment to this was posted by a reader. I hadn't thought about this. The Bar Association all the time has lawyers who stole money or drank and destroyed their client's case or just did illegal things. And if that happened in the context of being suspended, they always restore them. Hypocrisy runs so deep.
Yes, it does.
All right.
It's unfortunate.
But we were talking about Mayor Ganim and mayors trying to get more money from the state. We still have no state budget. We're getting, as people predicted, we're getting through August now with no state budget. We're supposed to get one on June 30th. And a lot of cuts coming down automatically until we get a budget. Mm-hmm. You've been dealing with this pretty heavily in the city. What is your update, Mayor Harp, on your contingency plans? How much money are we going to be down in general and at the schools, and what are we doing about it?
Well, we are likely to be down as much as a little over $60 million if there's no budget by the end of September. I think that we are in pretty good shape. We're in pretty good shape until the end of September. And if we don't get the cash infusion that we need by the end of September, we're gonna have a cash problem in the city. So we're really worried about that. I'm understanding, though, that the governor is in the process of doing another executive memo of some sort that will allocate education money.
So. That's been interesting. Let's see if he pulls this off. So the governor stated that what he's going to do when there's no budget, and this is a clever way to both do what he argued should have been done last time that wasn't, and to try to get the legislators, many of whom from the suburbs, to pass a budget. He said, look, we've already told the richest school districts, we're not going to give you more. We're going to send some of that to cities. Now we're going to take sort of the middle-class districts and take your money away, which is limited, because the cities can't afford to have big cuts in education.
Yeah, so he's asked the
secretary. They might be better off with no budget. Seriously, if the executive order by the governor?
I don't know, because, you know, it's oddly, New Haven is not one of the poorer cities, believe it or not. But he's asked.
Well, we're not in one of the worst cash positions. We've been balancing our budget while Hartford's looking for $40 million to avoid bankruptcy.
Right, and so I think that what they're looking to do is to have, what the governor has asked the secretary to do is to come up with all of these this information that he needs to get so he can rank cities as to those that are the most needy, and come up then with a formula through his and utilizing his executive order to then redistribute dollars based upon need.
So we're not going to do well with that?
I think we'll do okay, but I think people think we'll do a lot better than we will ultimately do.
So now, even though we don't look at issues this way in our city because we're the center of our own universe, 169 cities and towns are right now wrestling with emergencies if there's no state budget.
Absolutely.
And there's towns that are delaying the start of school for a week. So we're going to have to take some drastic actions. Cities are going to have to either raise taxes, have massive cutoffs, and in each town in their own world, people are going to be mad at the local politicians, right? And the state politicians probably, if it's not understood. But Bob, who usually calls in, couldn't, he had an appointment, sent in a question. Are we going to have to lay off teachers?
No. I will absolutely not do that unless the teachers are not teaching in the classroom and are funded by a grant that has been terminated. And this
will be an example of that.
Occasionally we get grants from various places. And so if we've gotten a grant for something very specific that utilizes a teacher, they're not in a classroom, then that's a possibility. But my understanding in discussions with the superintendent is that we are going to make sure that we utilize all teachers.
Now, so how are we going to make up millions of dollars? We're not going to delay schools opening, or is that on the table?
We're not delaying schools opening. We will have enough money until, as I said before, until the end of September. And what my finance team has done is said to all of our department heads, including education, that any of the contracts that we have out there that we don't have to negotiate right now and that are not needed to, say, start school or any of the work that we can hold up on, we're gonna just slow walk the contracting process.
Slow, okay. And then ultimately,
hoping that they will have a budget. Now, I've been told the reason that we don't have a budget yet is that there are so many people on vacation in the General Assembly.
That is outrageous. And we're not a statewide publication. I would love to ask each legislator what people should get a vacation, go away for 2 days, but in the midst of this?
That's what I've been told now. I don't know. And I know in the Senate, because the Senate is evenly divided, that there's, I've been told, some kind of an agreement that both sides have to have an equal number. And
that's fair. I like to see that going on.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. And so if people planned with their families to do things, I think that the leadership has said, you know, we're going to wait until at least in the Senate that it's equal. And we're going to think of August as a time that we get all of our ducks in a row. And I would think that by the beginning of September, they'll be willing to roll out a budget that can be passed in both houses.
Now, when you talk about $60 million at stake by the end of September, is that mostly money that no matter what happens with the budget, most of it we can count on, even
yes,
if they make the drastic cuts, because they still have $3.5 billion?
Yes, I think that we can count on most of those dollars.
Okay.
Most of it is education money.
Speaking of the Board of Education, now you've appointed a new member, Jamel Cotto.
Yep.
He had run for the Board of Ed. He decided not to run. Oh, happy Earth Day, Mayor Hart. I think they meant birthday. Naomi Greco, do you think that was a play on words? Because she went to the trouble of spelling it differently. It's not a typo.
Yeah, sure. Earth. I'm still on Earth.
All right. Mazel tov.
Yes.
So Jamel Cotto had been running against Ed Joyner for Board of
right.
Ed. He dropped out at the convention, but now he's going to be on the Board of Ed anyway. He's up on the website as an official board member, but he hasn't been approved yet by the alders. Does he need to be approved by the alders, or is this a special recess appointment or something?
No, it's not a special recess appointment. It does have to be approved by the Board of Alders. So
why did you pick him?
Because he worked really hard in the election. When he came to me, when he was first deciding to run, he was a parent, I think his son just graduated, and he's got a daughter at Career. He went through New Haven schools and his community. He works with Centro San Jose with young people, has for many, many years. And when I was in the state senate, I observed his work. He'd done really great work, but he just had fire around education. And I thought he was such a gentleman, the way that he withdrew from the race. And I thought, well, he still should have an opportunity to have an impact on education. We had an open seat, and I appointed him.
Gentlemen, do we need gentlemen in public office?
Well, you know, I think that in all honesty, we need people who understand how important it is to have a reasonable dialogue and to treat each other with respect. And I think that's something that he will do.
And we're doing that on Mayor Monday on WNHH Radio, your home for community radio at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Mayor Tony Harp is in the house. Mayor Harp, last week there was a big bond sale. We don't do those every day. We sold $43.4 million of bonds to finance capital projects. These are not for operating expenses, which is supposed to be a big no-no. For stuff like bridges, sidewalks, IT, which big need in New Haven, Stetson Library, housing, body cameras, another $33.4 million to retire the debt. Now, this is way above my expertise level, but my understanding is that the good news is we had a decent bond rating, A- stable for Standard & Poor's. That enables us to get a pretty good interest rate. The downside is that we couldn't get it insured, so that upped the price a little bit. But refinancing the bonds helped. That you don't generally, we talked to a guy from a Center for Municipal Finance, University of Chicago. He said, you usually don't want more than 8 to 10% of your budget on debt service. Our $66.7 million is 12.8%. But he also said that cities that have ratings at our level do generally do that amount, that you consider a little bit safer, so it's okay. Mm-hmm. But then something else happened last week, which is that the city settled a lawsuit from way before when you were mayor. A guy named Scott Lewis wrote many articles about this. He was a drug dealer who got set up for a murder of an alder you knew, Ricardo Turner, mm-hmm. in 1990. And his lover were murdered in their bed in the Hill. And a crooked detective named Vincent Rauchy, who was involved in the drug trade, with some pretty big-time guys. They're the kind of guys from Branford, New Haven, who were sort of the New England mafia distributors. And he was very tight with them. This was all revealed, by the way, in an FBI report. Oh, the LD Advocate got a copy of and published that was not allowed at this guy's trial. Talk about exculpatory evidence. So this guy got set up by this cop for a murder through fabricated evidence, spent 18 years in jail fighting it. Yale Law students and others helping him. He finally got out a couple of years ago, and he sued the city. And the city tried to get the federal judge, Underhill, who's a great judge, in Bridgeport, to throw it out. He won, and he said this trial's going forward. So he settled it for $9.5 million. Whew.
It's a lot.
A lot.
Could have been more, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's why you settle these things. I mean, you were in a tight spot there.
Yeah.
So that adds to our indebtedness. How much is that going to cost us per year? Do you know, you're asking to borrow the money?
I don't really know how much it is per year, but I know that in our discussions with the lawyers, they basically thought we could have gotten $1 million a year, and that would have been even worse. So,
what do you mean $1 million a year?
Well, I mean, if we had gone on, and you know, a judge could have decided that $1 million a year was reasonable.
I mean, for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Well, for at least the 18 years that he spent in jail.
Oh. I mean, that's the kind of standard.
Yeah. Yeah. It has happened in the past, and so we felt like we had to do it. I'm not certain how much it costs us every year, but it's you know, when police officers do things like that, and it impacts someone's life, you know, the other system, the judicial system, is going to exact a high price.
Yeah. I remember early on in his quest, I visited him in jail, what was so interesting is that you try to be skeptical when you talk to people, but I happen to have that FBI report, which mm-hmm. was amazing to me that the state continued fighting it and not letting him go when it was revealed that the detective was so dirty and fabricated so much. But they said he's going to have to earn it, so he spent 18 years. But I remember going to jail, and after I interviewed him, I talked to one of the guards who'd been there a long time. It's actually a guard you know. And he said, everybody here says they're innocent, and we learned to be skeptical. But I really believe this guy. I really believe this guy. And he had sort of a Buddhist approach. He said, I know my time's coming. And he went through the whole 18 years through appeals. He became an incredible jailhouse lawyer on his own. He would mm-hmm. overrule some of his own lawyers. We felt they weren't doing it right. And it took a long time. And it had these federal judges. It was a state case. And federal judges wrote a scathing opinion about how state judges allowed this for so many years to keep going on and turn the other way. It's really remarkable.
It's unfortunate, and we're paying for it.
Yeah, and so how are we going to avoid cases like this in the future, detectives who fabricate evidence and things like that?
Well, you know, certainly we have to have a command structure that respects the law and assures that all of the officers that participate in our police department are honest. And if they're not, we've got to help them find another form of employment. It's that simple. One of the things that we're doing from a psychological point of view, where we are now, because I think that, you know, there are only certain types of people who can be what I would consider to be double agents. And, you know, somebody's got to be able to figure that out prior to our hiring them. And so we are now having a behavioral health group look at, one, what it is we require of our people who do the behavioral health backgrounds, and to make sure that they're not unintentionally discriminatory, but also to make sure that we're getting the right kind of people in this field. You know, like, obviously someone wasn't in the command structure that was overseeing these folks, because it probably took a number of people to do this.
It's funny how much they sing about Chief Pastor. Attention. And Chief Pastor actually did try to catch this cop.
Mm-hmm.
They had, when he went to the bathroom, they actually got the plumber to let them collect the urine to try to show he had drugs in his system. Because actually, by coincidence, I met this guy who used to run with him doing cocaine all the time, do big pickups while he was on duty. And he was all the time. But the time they catch his urine, they didn't get him. And I knew this cop. He was in some ways a very talented cop. He had incredible instincts.
Mm-hmm.
And so other cops were following him on the highway at times, and he always knew when they were getting close, and he would quickly go off a highway and get away if he had drugs on him.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, he was sharper than they were at escaping it.
Well, I think that we've got to find ways to identify these people and root them out, long story short.
Okay. Edward Trimble wrote in. You remember, he's in the Hill.
Okay.
Happy Born Day, Mayor Harp. You're doing a wonderful job. Keep up the good work.
Oh, that's sweet.
Now,
Thank you.
He's a man who has lost his son to gun violence in the city, has had reasons not to be happy with the police, but he's happy with the job you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
And some people are not happy in East Rock because there's a new homeless encampment. Last winter, there was one that the city dismantled in Cedar Hill on state land off the highway in the woods. Really dangerous place for the homeless people there. There'd be tents with, like, those kind of fires right in the tents. And the neighbors were concerned about stuff, but the city did not throw them out in one day. They worked with everybody, brought social workers, health people, try to assess them, get them into places. But some people just don't want to go in for whatever reasons. There's a new encampment near the Ralph Waters skating rink, and you've had people there working on it. What's the status of that?
Well, you know, we're hoping to move them. We're finding out about these encampments, and certainly there's one there. You know, like, every day somebody's calling about another place where they've seen people, you know, camping out in our city. And so one of the things that I've asked Martha Okafor and her team to do is to try to figure out what is driving this, because it's certainly more than what occurred previously. And what I think is happening, what she seems to think is happening, but we've really got to make sure that this is the case, is that the state, in its interest to determine who's homeless and to have good data, requires it's very difficult for homeless people to just go to a homeless shelter. They have to meet certain standards, and there are male shelters, female shelters, are there on different floors, and if people are together, they can't be together.
That's one big thing we hear at these places, that couples who want to be together.
Got to be clean. Oftentimes you have to have money. There are all of these rules. And so years ago, there weren't as many rules. And I think that some of these rules are being driven by state policy. And we've got to take a look at that, because I think it's really driving people outside and actually endangering people that they're trying to protect through the various programs that they have.
That's very interesting. Wow. Okay. And, you know, another thing, so we hear that thing about the couples. There are a lot of people, they have drug problems.
Yep.
And they're not ready to kick that drug problem.
Yep.
And they're not from here. They come here for their methadone, but they're really not from here. And that becomes a tricky conversation.
Well, one of the things that we are going to try to do is to have a conversation about how methadone is provided in our community. One of the things that happened that I didn't realize, I learned after we became mayor, was that because I've always supported drug treatment, I think it's really important that people have it, that they have it on demand. And I know that it's difficult to get because there aren't enough slots. Well, evidently, at some point, the General Assembly passed a bill that limited the expansion of methadone programs to cities that already had them. And so we...
Boy, I wonder what kind of legislature passes that if it isn't run by the cities. Wow.
Wow. Wow.
Wow.
And so...
That's deep.
And so we have 6 or 7 methadone clinics here in our town. And different ones provide it differently, but some of what occurs, it just is not working for our city. And so that's another thing that we're going to take a look at.
How do we look at it?
We've got to meet with some of the providers, and I don't really want to mention their names on the air, but we've got to meet.
Would it be an apt thing to do on the air?
Oh, my goodness, you're naughty, naughty, naughty. But, you know, like, I'm getting a lot of complaints, particularly over on Congress Avenue. You know, it would seem to me that if you really value your patients, that you don't have them waiting outside, that you find ways to treat them so that if they need to come here from other towns, that they get transportation right back to where they live. We don't have that happening. We have a lot of people who then loiter in our city in the green and
The cops downtown, I saw one video where they just talk to these people who are so nodding out of it.
Yes.
And they're just non-functional.
I've seen that, you know, as I've walked through the green, and it's like, something's wrong with the practice model if that's happening.
On the other hand, did you see that story in the Times about New Haven, the jail, how we are embracing methadone treatment in jails when other places aren't, and how important they believe it is to help people?
I think it's important, too, but I also think that you've got to respect people and treat them decently, and also respect the community that you're in.
So Jesse J. Hop Hardy, who works with the homeless, and I love this about Facebook. I don't love everything about Facebook, and I really don't want it for my personal life, but he's in real time. He says Yale is driving these homeless people here with their trials for drugs and methadone.
That's possible. We've really got to get to the bottom of it because they're coming from all over the state. At first, we thought they were just coming from Waterbury.
I always used to hear Waterbury at
Compton. Yeah, but they're coming from as far away as Willimantic. I mean, it's...
Willimantic?
Yeah, that's what I was...
That's Heroin Hotel City.
That's
an hour away.
I know. But they come here, and then it's really hard for them to get back. So it could be fueling both of those problems.
Forget the bus.
Yeah.
7 weeks if you want to bus back to Waterbury. Willimantic. Willimantic.
Yeah, that's what I was told.
There's nothing on the whole eastern half of New Haven?
I was told that, and, you know, I think that they have their own programs, but our programs are different. It's a different kind of recovery model, and I think people can get methadone with dirty urines, and that's, you know, we've got to look at all of that and hear it.
And you can't do that in other programs?
A lot of other programs won't let you.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
And it's also interesting that you listen to Mayor Monday at WNHH Radio, 103.5 FM, live stream, newhavenimpin.org. I love when people are weighing in, even if it's just to say happy birthday, but also when they have something to say, because Jesse Hardy is in these encampments.
He knows.
I've seen him in the encampments. He knows better than anyone in New Haven why they're there. And we know better than all of us know him. We would have loved to have had Aretha Franklin sing at the Yale Bowl for her farewell concert. I understand it ain't going to happen. That was a little bit too late in the process. But did anything good come out of that process of getting approval to have concerts again after many years of not at the tennis center? Is this maybe something we're going to pursue?
Well, I think that we would like to pursue it, and I know the folks at the Connecticut Tennis Foundation would like to pursue it. It is a venue, we think, for large concerts and can help defray some of the costs of doing the Connecticut Open every year.
And not just the Open, I think it's a great thing for the city. I live a few blocks away, and even if I don't go to the concerts at all, I vote to have them.
You do?
I think that's part of what makes a city.
I think so, too.
I went to those concerts in the 90s, some of them, and it was very beautiful evenings. It was not raining, which it wasn't, and a good sound system, and just a lovely place to have a concert. And I think that if you don't want to live in a city, don't live in a city.
Oh, that's an interesting point.
I think we have this resource we don't use 51 or 50 weeks a year.
Yeah.
The state spent $18 million to build back when $18 million meant something. And it's a great venue for concerts. Why not have some of them? I was a little mixed about Aretha. She's one of my favorite performers ever.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't hit the high notes anymore.
Well, but you know what happens with those in my generation who no longer hit the high notes? They throw the microphone out to the crowd and the crowd hits them for them.
I'm always wondering that because like I don't want to see Bob Dylan, who's my favorite. I stopped seeing him 15 years ago. He wasn't good in concert anymore. And I was thinking part of it is maybe the joy of reliving something that's just exciting to be there with other people and hearing it.
Yeah.
But for me, I kind of feel like it's you have to imagine something that no longer exists to enjoy the moment.
Yeah.
I'm over intellectualizing this. It's fun for some people, not others.
Yeah.
I would have gone, I bet. I might have gone just because I love Aretha Franklin so much.
Yeah.
There's something, those early recordings, the energy of them, and it just...
her voice was phenomenal.
The vibrancy of that voice.
Yeah.
Okay, we have a question from Edward Trimble. Any updates on the new Q House on Dixwell Avenue?
Yes. It was slowed down because, unfortunately, the architect passed away. And all
Ed
of
Sherry?
That, no. No, he's
Regina
still here.
Winter, Regina
Regina Winters. And... and all of the drawings and the resources that we pretty much paid for all of that were in probate for about 9 months.
Wow!
I think
drawings in probate.
Yeah, and so we had to get another. She had a partner architect, but the drawings were hers, and so in order to sort of redistribute all of that, it had to go through probate. It's done that. The city engineer has gone over, and we've discovered there are a few problems with the site that'll cost us a little bit more. But we're moving forward. We'll break ground in the spring. There are just some pipes under there that no one saw before. Giovanni Zinn took a look.
He's good.
He's very good.
So what happens with these pipes?
I think that we're going to just have to do a little bit of adjustment of the...
they need removal?
Yeah, I think they may have to be moved. Or the building itself may have to be reoriented some way.
But you're still saying a spring groundbreaking.
Yes. I spoke to Giovanni on Friday, and he said that we will be breaking ground in the spring.
All right. That's good news. You were in New Hallville last week for community meeting and dinner
mm-hmm.
with the management team, which I guess has been reconstituted. They talked about all that new housing coming at that lot off Henry near Munson. Then you mentioned a new senior housing across the street at that vacant lot. Not
right.
on Munson, but where Munson is near Henry, near the edge of Monterey Place. What's that all about?
Well, that's housing, I think, that has been planned to be there for many, many years. LCI is in the process of finding a developer, if they haven't already, to develop that site.
Is there money for it? Or?
I believe so, yeah.
And is this to replace Edith B. Johnson, or is that staying in
business?
Oh, no,
that's staying. It's just, we just have a need for more of that type of housing.
Senior housing. So how many units?
You know what? I'll have to get you next
okay,
week.
Fair,
okay. I'll give you the
and in the meantime,
full rundown.
You're going to be near Tweed New Haven Airport today. You're not taking a flight, are you?
No, I'm going to look at the soundproofing that's going on there.
And so you're going to a few housing. And how is that going with the soundproofing?
It's really great. I think that we got about a little over $3 million from the FAA to continue that project.
Well, we're going to let readers of the Independent find out more about that today when Alan Appel joins you there along
great.
With the whole crew. Tom Breen just sent another question. Any updates on the Escape, that youth center that has been delayed at next to Bethel AME Church at the Community Outreach Center?
No, we're still moving forward on the Escape, and I think that they're actually looking at doing some drawings, looking at some of the work that was done there, and you'll be seeing something start up really soon right there.
All right. Should we at least mention that police officer Joshua Castellano jumped 8 fences in the hill near Rosette Street last week?
Oh, wow.
There was a guy who was breaking in and threatening a woman and got called in.
Mm-hmm.
He saw the cops. He jumped over 8 fences. Joshua Castellano jumped over 8 fences while his partner drove around the block, and they caught the guy.
That's phenomenal. Congratulations.
Good job, Officer Castellano.
That's absolutely phenomenal.
What do you think? How many fences can you and I jump?
Listen.
I've never jumped a fence in my entire life.
I haven't either. You know, the only thing that the way it might happen is if I have some sort of pole.
Politician pole vaulting.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today at Dateline Haven. Thank you, Mayor Harp.
Thank you.
Off next week.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm out of town.
Oh, good. Finally, you're off.
I'm off. God, hallelujah. Looking forward to it. My wife and I are going to Airbnb in Central Mass near a lake.
Oh, that should be fun. We'll enjoy.
And please don't make any major news for a week.
Well, we'll try. We'll try
Count
really hard.
You got to stay budget.
That would be helpful.
Okay, that's a deal. And thanks to Birch and Moses and Devlin PC, Gateway Community College, for providing financial support for today's show. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the CD A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass reminding us all that we do know what it feels like to be free. We just have to book our flight. Book your flight and fly free with us all day and all night long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio. Thank you.